This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, it's 5 minutes after seven. It is time for us to check in all the important stories. He sent me a message at like midnight last night. The man does not sleep. Justice Malala is here. Hey, Justice, how are you?
Good, how are you guys?
Are you good?
Yeah.
You get any sleep? Barely any.
Nah, I did get some sleep. All so right. Good.
So the Burning Platform is brought to you every week by Nando's. We check in on all the big stories that everybody's interested in. And Justice has always got a whole armory of stuff, but sometimes he says to me, I'm not really sure what to go with on this. So I don't know. I mean, there's probably plenty to talk about, but you did give an agenda to me. And, you know, it was Freedom Day on the 27th, last Friday. And then it was Workers' Day yesterday. I mentioned to everybody yesterday that I saw Bladen Zimande standing up at the Workers' Day thing. And he was... It could have been 40 years ago. It could have been 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Nothing has changed in Blade world because he's just older, but the messaging is the same.
Yeah.
Mandla and the crowd kind of give this dispirited... It's like about 20% of the audience he's used to for a Workers' Day celebration. He's wearing his red SACP cap. And you know, it goes back to what we spoke about last week with like no new ideas, no young people to take over in that party in the SACP, but more generally in politics in South Africa.
No, absolutely. You know? I have to say I struggle to find something in the May Day messages or the May Day rallies and all the other activities that was sort of new and fresh and, you know, kind of like this is 2018, man.
And we do have new challenges and we do have things in society that are of concern for young people and for people in general in South Africa. And it seems that the politicians just so out of touch. They're drumming out the same messages they've always done. Cyril stands up and dances a little. And it's kind of anachronistic.
Well, it's that confluence between politics and trade unionism. But it's also, you know, trade unions came about because of the Industrial Revolution, because of industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
When people started going to work en masse in factories, on farms and so forth. And it wasn't, you know, Gareth chipping away, raising five cows on a farm all by himself there. It was the idea of the working class grew out of progress in economies across the world. And we are now, you know, people are talking about a whole new world of work, a whole new way of working. And I don't know if, you know, did anyone say anything about Uber workers, for example?
No.
Because that's those the new world of work.
And they left alone to fend for themselves against
exactly
seemingly lawless taxi drivers.
Exactly.
And violence is meted out on these guys every other day.
I mean, I would be interested to find out if anyone said anything about the precariousness of work, the fact that so many people who should have been in those stadia, people who now work, who could have a job today and no job tomorrow if you're an Uber worker or a taxi driver.
Or a miner, because we know that's going to change. And with this, what they call the fourth industrial revolution,
exactly,
which essentially means that we're going to be replaced in unskilled labor by machines.
Exactly.
Surely, like, Blade should be addressing that if he cares about workers. And on Workers' Day all over the world, which also seems like, you know, it's kind of a sad...
It's a sad relic of
nostalgic.
The past century. Yes. You know, I mean, if you take some of the messages that have been going on, and I'm not knocking the fight for a living wage, for all that. I fully agree, and I think that all those things should be done. But I think that if you took 2018 and went back to 1918 and listened to what Stalin was or Lenin was saying in then and now, it's pretty much the same thing. We haven't, political parties are not grappling with what's changed and how do we deal with the fact that, you know, Sia might be doing a job here. It's the gig economy, the fact that so many people are not in jobs but are in jobs. So, you know, you do a job here, then you hop on to the next one, and then you hop on to the third one. That so many people are putting together a package but they're totally not in the mainstream. Oh, I've got to earn the 20 rand per hour or do this. People have to make do in a very different environment. But if you listen to NUMSA, which banged on about Cyril Ramaphosa and how he's a capitalist and bad and so forth, or you listen to Safdie, or you listen to Kosatu, or you listen to Blade, there isn't a grappling with the fact that the world has changed. The world is changing very fast. The fact that so many people work on Facebook or Google and so forth, and with that we're not just people who work in factories, and that many people who work in factories.
When I listen to a lot of those speeches, whether people like Irvin Jim have ever been on the internet. Like, do they know how the internet works? At very least, the young politicians like Julius Malema have some idea of how to use social media to their advantage. And even then, their understanding of it has changed over time. Remember, Julius at one point wanted to ban Twitter, which I think right now wouldn't be such a bad idea, if I must be honest. But you did also mention to me that you thought Freedom Day was worth reflecting on. Now, there's a day that we do still have a huge amount to reflect on and to be, I suppose, quite optimistic about, because we don't take stock. We don't think about how much in these 25-odd years has happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Can I just finish off the trade unions? I just wanted to say, it's amazing that you have Kosatu. Kosatu has been such a big feature of our lives since the 1980s when it was formed, and before that Safdie. But all these massive trade union federations are going through quite an upheaval. Kosatu, we forget that NUMSA walked out of Kosatu. That's 350,000 people walking out of one federation. They formed SATU now. There's all kinds of shenanigans going on in Kosatu, and it's possible, there is lots of talk, that the NUM might walk out of Kosatu and move with NUMSA into SAFTU. If that happens, Kosatu essentially becomes a trade union of civil servants, or a federation of civil servants. Remember, the biggest trade union in Kosatu now is NEHAU, which is the Health and Allied Workers Union. They are the guys who were trashing Charlotte Maxeke yesterday and the day before.
Emptying medical waste into the passages.
Exactly. The second biggest, I think, is SATU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union. They're the guys who are protecting students who are busy trying to... that sort of stuff. So increasingly you have a Kosatu that is aligned to the government, aligned to the ANC, because they get, you know, a little something here, a little something there to stay happy, to be happy, to continue to be...
But it's it becomes almost like an elite situation, because they have a special communication line to the government that the other unions don't.
Which is why 4 years ago, public servants received not just, I think it was a 7% increase, but on top of that, housing allowance and this allowance and so forth and so forth. And the budget nearly collapsed, the South African budget nearly collapsed, because at the time under Jacob Zuma, we just wanted to give civil servants what they wanted, and we did. And right now, negotiations are on between those trade unions, NEHAU, SATU, the public service, and government. So are we going to give them a big whack, meaning that money for roads, money for other stuff, then goes to salaries for civil servants? So there's a whole thing going on about the relationship between government, the ANC government, and those trade unions. And whether, you know, when we negotiate to them, we give them nice stuff because we want to keep them on side.
And while we're talking about these guys, Justice, you know this better than anyone. So what are the actual numbers? I mean, what percentage of the total working population does Kosatu, for example, represent? And compare that to the numbers of unemployed people in the country, and it looks like a drop in the ocean, right?
Well, the unemployed in South Africa stand at about 9 million. That's 9 million able-bodied persons, 18 people between 18 and... everyone above 18 who doesn't work. That's 9 million. Huh. The trade unions have organized about 2.5 to 3 million people. So in fact, there is another trade union. It's the unemployed, and they are huge, huge numbers. So I think the key thing with these negotiations and with all these trade unions is that next year we have an election. If trade unions in the public sector don't get a nice salary increase, will they say Ramaphosa for president again, or will they think once, twice, three times, and find someone else?
And isn't it interesting that Cyril Ramaphosa comes from the trade unions? That was his genesis.
Yeah, yeah. He launched the same National Union of Mine Workers, which has lost support in the trade in the platinum sector, in the coal sector, and so forth. And in fact, it's on the might move to the new trade union SAFTU. Until AMCU came along, you'll remember that in 1987, he led the biggest trade union strike in South Africa, with mine workers going on strike for 6 weeks, I think. And lots of people dying as well in some of those protests at that time. But the 2012 AMCU strike in the platinum sector led to a whole different scenario playing out.
So we know about that.
Yeah, but essentially the NUM has almost collapsed in the northwest, in the platinum belt, collapsing in the coal sector in Mpumalanga, and not much else in the gold and so forth, and has been surpassed by AMCU. So all sorts of things going on, even as people stand up and say all these nice things or not so nice things at these rallies. But the idea of work and the idea of trade unions is now becoming more and more strained. And it's actually, your question is very valid. And it's, what is the role of trade unions in 2018 in South Africa or elsewhere when trade unions are becoming less and less? If you work in a factory, say, in the East Rand, and you're working for, say, Tiger Brands, and it turns out that your company has not dealt with issues of health on the shop floor, and suddenly your product has listeriosis or doesn't have listeriosis, what does your trade union do for you if you're one of the 3,000 people who work in this factory and might lose their jobs?
Yeah.
You know, this is the big question about trade unions now. What value did they add?
And even the weapons that they have in their arsenal that used to be powerful. I mean, these days, you know, you have to question march after march. You know, there's this ridiculous cartoon that I saw. I mean, I think it's very funny, where every working day you see protests, and on workers' day you just see placards lying on the ground. I'm curious as to, like, what kinds of tools the trade unions have at their disposal now in order to break through the noise, to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, you can still go on strike, but the law is calibrated in such a way that actually the worker takes a hit as much as the employer. You withdraw your labor, yes, so I stop making a profit as the employer, but you also lose your salary while you're on strike. So you feel the pinch as much, maybe even more than the employer, because the employer can survive, whereas if you lose half your salary and you're a worker living in Soshanguve or in Meadowlands or wherever, you know, for many, many people, if you don't get that full salary at the end of the month, suddenly you're very precarious. You're about to fall off. So,
and it must irritate the people in the unions, particularly if you've worked hard to become a shop steward or whatever else in the union, and you see the people at the very top of the organization who are treated like the elite politicians. They get given cabinet posts, or they get escalated into the chain of command, or they get put into cushy jobs somewhere so that they can be deployed where needed. And it almost feels that the workers are used as a means to elevate certain people in the unions.
Yeah, no, that's why.
And then you have breakaway unions and so on as a result.
But if you look at the reasons why, I mean, that Marikana implosion of the NUM was very interesting, because what happened with the NUM is that guys who have a bit of an education, who work on the mines, become the leaders of the NUM, become the shop stewards, become leaders of the trade union. Then, you know, suddenly Mabale has become the HR manager of the on the site. And before you know it, she's in management.
Mm.
Suddenly your own leader is on the other side of the fence and earning a better salary and so forth. A lot of NUM shop stewards became senior employees of the mines, and so ended up being the bosses themselves and being moving to the other side, and now saying, Gareth, I'm sorry, but you know, you can't do that now. And you say, but I thought we were on the same side. It's no, I'm in management now,
right?
And the workers can, you know. So I think that's put a lot of strain. And the NUM, for example, and other trade unions have had to think about that. A lot of guys who are in the trade unions end up on the other side, in the HR department, having to deal with the same trade union that they used to be members of and used to be, but they are now management.
Well, it's all about dealing with change.
Yeah.
So let's reflect on Freedom Day for a second. We don't often get the time or the chance to look back and to see how many freedoms we enjoy now that we take for granted. You know, the way a child is able to grow up in South Africa now as compared to the way that particularly a black child would have grown up in South Africa in the 1980s is the vast, vast differences are almost innumerable. But let's take stock. How are you feeling after Freedom Day?
Oh, no. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that happened to people like me and people like us who talk about these things all the time is that sometimes we forget. I just, you know, the past few weeks I've been thinking a lot about people running around saying, yeah, you know, there are spies in the media and, oh, you know, Stratcom 40 and all these libelous things that people have been saying. But I wanted to think about 1980s. Let's take 1988.
Hmm.
1988, if you took a newspaper like the Weekly Mail, which is now the Mail and Guardian, you know, we sit here and we talk about, we give everyone a bit of hell on this show, and we talk about, you know, Julius and then, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa and all these other people.
Sure.
But in 1988, you couldn't say the word, the acronym, ANC.
Right.
You couldn't mention that organization. You couldn't mention PAC or Steve Biko or Azapo or Black Consciousness Movement. All these things.
You'd have had eyes on you.
You'd have gone straight into detention without trial. So, you know, Sia would have been thrown into jail this afternoon because, you know, he said ANC on air.
Imagine that, Sia, you would not survive.
You know, particularly Sia likes to say ANC on air.
All the time. All the time.
It's like saying Cardi B. So
which ironically can get you locked up for other reasons these days.
But you know, so it's incredible that where we've come from, and I think some of these freedoms, the freedoms to express, I mean, the freedoms to say stuff that we sometimes might be just outrageous to some people, but we've got these freedoms enshrined in our constitution, the ability to speak and say these things. I think that's the first thing. I think that the political freedoms that we've won are something that we should appreciate. But you know, when you look back 24 years, you also have to say, what is this 24 years about? And there's a lot of talk and a lot of even revisionism, if you will, about no, Nelson Mandela and his comrades were sellouts or this and so forth. You know, I've actually find it sometimes offensive when people say people like Nelson Mandela were sellouts. Where we got to 24 years after 1994 is by no small measure because of people like Nelson Mandela. And I think it's outrageous, actually, that people should turn around and say they are.
Well, like they could have done better in the circumstances.
I find it amazing that people who... But for me, the key thing is that it's also to misunderstand the idea of where we are and how we got here. Because the key for me is that a space was opened up for us to achieve things. So if you take the land debate, for example, there is nothing over the past 24 years that stopped us from enacting laws, from implementing land reform and land restitution in a manner that might not have led us to where we are today, where we don't seem to know what we're doing and what we want to achieve in terms of land reform and so forth and so forth. So I think that we have I think 24 years later, one, we mustn't
I like
forget.
That very considered pause.
I think that 24 years later, we mustn't ignore the incredible things that we have achieved as a country. And the incredible freedom that we have achieved. That said, I think that we do sometimes or have sometimes wasted the chances that we have. I think that the past 10 years were wasted. We made bad political choices. Remember, Sia, we voted for President Jacob Zuma, you and I. So
semantics, but let's go with you and I, sure.
So I think that we need to reflect on that we are political actors ourselves and that we can't absolve ourselves of the responsibilities of what happened here over the past 10 years and the setbacks that have been suffered. But that said, I think that it's worth remembering where we've come from and maybe resetting ourselves and saying, given the enormity of those victories that we have scored, we need to do better and we need to use the space a little bit better.
Let's just talk about something international that affects us all, because we often talk about how, you know, there's PEPFAR and there are all these other initiatives that are meant to improve trade relations between South Africa and the US in particular, but the world. Mm. And there are good initiatives, and there were a lot of good initiatives. Ironically, there were a lot more under George W. Bush than under Obama or Trump. And now Trump looks like he's putting America first, and he's going to cost us some jobs in this country when it comes to aluminium and steel.
Yeah, you know, Donald Trump is in the news every day. You know, if it's not his lawyer being raided the other day, I saw his doctor.
Right.
Was it yesterday? His doctor saying that Donald Trump actually dictated the letter saying that he's in absolutely fantastic health. And I mean, you got to love
it. Just signed it.
You know, when I go to my doctor, I'm sitting there so and pretending to be sicker than I actually am so that he can really give me a nice letter saying, oh, Justice is really sick. This guy arrives and says, hey, Ben, you know, write this down, and dictates the letter. The doctor says, I had to tell him that, no, you can't put that in a letter. It's like, it's too much, man. It's too good. Anyway, he's in the news every day, but you know, Donald Trump said before he was elected, after he was elected, that America first. He said that he'll make America great again, and he particularly wanted to remove the ability of foreign and South African companies to import steel into the U.S., aluminium and steel, into the U.S. because he said they're killing the U.S. steel industry. Well, he's gone and done it. And on Monday, he signed, you know, not lots of people were following this stuff. And it's very, you know, sometimes you don't follow the trade negotiations and so forth. But he basically said South Africa is no longer in the list of countries that get an exemption. That means that when what are steel companies, ArcelorMittal or so forth, produces steel here, sends it off to the U.S., we used to not pay tariffs on it. Now we have to pay. And that means our steel is more expensive than everyone, many other people's. That means that Americans will not be buying steel and aluminium from South Africa. That means that we don't have a customer anymore. If we don't raise a new customer, and it's like unlikely that we will raise a new customer unless the Chinese or someone else comes on board, and we don't know if they have that appetite for steel because they are not building as much as they used to build, right. That means that jobs will be lost in South Africa. Now, you know that the platinum sector has taken a beating, so jobs are being lost there, and we are likely, may lose 5,700 jobs. You can put a number to these things.
Wow.
If Donald Trump goes ahead. There is no reason to think that Donald Trump will not go ahead with it because he's already signed who will be in the exemption. So steel from Canada will be exempted from the tariff. Steel from Mexico will be exempted from the
The Mexicans, he doesn't mind, suddenly.
Exactly. South Korea.
We're being punished.
But we have been punished in this case. And so suddenly you see all that global political play, all that stuff coming on board. And there will be winners and there'll be losers. And in this case, we are losing to Donald Trump's politics of America First, and you know, I don't think this will be the first or the last of it. I think that there will be American policies that will come on stream and Trumpian policies that will come on stream that are going to affect us, that are going to affect our job situation, and as Trump tries to win his next election and tries to make people love him more, I think that we will find ourselves in a situation where we take a bit of a hit.
All right, let's just talk about Cyril, because we spoke about Supra Mahumapelo last week and what's going on in the Northwest and what an awkward situation this is. In fact, isn't it true that Cyril flew back from, I think, his UK state visit to deal with the problems in Mahikeng.
Yeah.
And now people are saying, well, he's a lame duck because he can't fire Supra. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had an extraordinary session with Sipho Seepe and Prince Mashele, in which I left my studio feeling like, oh my word, these guys are so... They were so negative, so down on Cyril Ramaphosa that I couldn't believe it. I thought, wow, it's incredible. And they were saying, why did he fly all the way from the UK, get here and didn't fire Supra Mahumapelo? This shows that he's a lame duck and da da da, so forth. Many other people have expressed the same thing, that the Ramaphosa euphoria is over and so forth and da da da. I thought it's worth reflecting on that. Cyril Ramaphosa came to power on the 18th of December. He won out of 5,220 delegates to the ANC conference. He won by 139 votes.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a slim majority that he just, you know, when you just, you know, it's like Ben and Mabale are in this race and they're going. And it's, who'll win? Who's coming through? It's Ben. No, it's Mabale. By just.
You would think a margin, the tiniest.
And we all sit in there and say, no, but Mabale didn't win. It can't be true. And it's, no, okay, she won, but just an inch. Just. So Cyril Ramaphosa comes together with that sort of, comes through with that sort of win. His side or his faction doesn't win outright. So you have Ace Magashule winning by 24 votes over Senzo Mchunu.
Talk about narrow margin.
Very narrow margin. So this is not Cyril walked in on his massive big horse and, you know, took over. It's, oh, let me sidle in. And he sidles in and tries to change this.
It's like our metros. It's all compromise.
It's all compromise. So since then, he manages to fire Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. He manages to fire 10 ministers. He stabilizes the rand somewhat, not him personally. You see action starting at Eskom, action starting at Denel, new boards, all these things happening and so forth. And I think people who say, no, he's a lame duck and so forth, I think yes, he faces big problems. He is a bit of a lame duck in the sense that he can't do what he wants to do immediately and forcefully. And
but don't we also have unrealistic expectations? I mean, these things don't happen overnight in politics. There are people who are very entrenched.
Exactly.
There are things that we don't understand about how the ANC's internal mechanisms work. And only, I mean, not even ANC people understand how some of those things
work. I mean, I'm amazed that ANC people, for example, don't realize that you can't fire... You can't just walk in and fire a premier, for example.
Yeah.
Cyril can say, we need to fire Supra. Supra then needs to say, the National Working Committee of the ANC, which is 25 people, then needs to say, yes, we agree. Then they have to go to the National Executive Committee of the ANC and say, we recommend that this one vacate office. And only then... Can you get rid of the guy? So the NEC of the ANC sits at the end of May.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, yesterday, the NWC sat, and I hear little murmurings all over the place that they may have recommended that Supra must go. So if you take all that, it's actually... The fact that Cyril came back home, it's been 2 weeks... You need to understand that this process, if he goes and fires the guy, the next NEC meeting Jacob Zuma is going to attend, by the way, because he's a member of the NEC.
Of course, and he sees that as an opportunity to rally his troops.
Exactly. He would have said, but comrades, the rules, because Jacob Zuma is very good on the rules of the ANC, he'd have said... But
of course, that's how he manipulated them into his...
Exactly. He's very good at that.
In its
so
favor,
he'd have jumped up and said, but comrades, the rules say that only the NEC can fire a premier. So why did you go there personally and act like you're a little dictator and fire the guy? Uh-huh. So Cyril has to now walk
plus
on
plus it creates a vacuum in the Northwest, which the ANC can ill afford at the moment, as exactly. We discussed last week. You want to listen to that episode of The Burning Platform? Then download it now.
But also, you think about if you go and do all these things just, you know, haphazardly, the EFF won a ward in Kolini, I think, in a by-election.
Do you know where that is?
It's in the Northwest somewhere.
Okay.
It's a lovely place.
I don't know whether.
I like to stop there and have a little drink.
All right.
Oh.
Indeed. It's a lovely stop.
See, has never Kolini. Been to Kolini either. So.
No. Ben looks like he's been to Kolini.
Sure. It's on my top 10.
I think, Mabale, you need to come through for Kolini.
No. No, I'm going to stick with my Free State roots. I already get enough flack for that. Thank you very much.
Kolini sounds like it's in the Free State, doesn't it?
Just in case anyone's wondering, that's Mabali speaking in her capacity as the Premier of Kwakwa.
There we go. Yes.
I mess around with her. You'll be sorry.
Moving on swiftly.
Yeah.
So the point is this. The ANC has a problem. If Supra Mahumapelo stays on, they'll continue to lose important wards like the one in Kolini and others. If Cyril gets rid of him suddenly, haphazardly, then the fight back will begin inside the ANC. People like our friend from the Free State, Ace Magashule, will be jumping up and down and saying, no, we can't do this to our comrade, and so forth and so forth. So Cyril has to walk very, very carefully around all these things. Otherwise, you know, there's a problem, and that problem will be that he opens himself up for challenges from all sorts of people. So my view really is that what do people want to see from Cyril Ramaphosa? It's most likely in my view that Supra Mahumapelo will go. I think Supra Mahumapelo is gone, basically. There is no way that he can stay on in the Northwest. If he stays on in the Northwest, Rustenburg will fall into the hands of the EFF. Other parts will fall into the DA's hands, Mahikeng, others. DA and EFF will most probably win there. And the provincial election next year will show... what do young people say? We'll show the ANC. They'll show them flames. Is that
flames? That's right.
That's it.
Justice, this is quite an interesting case study. I mean, the Northwest is you know, we tend to dismiss provinces outside of KZN, Gauteng, Western Cape, and we say, oh, well, you know, nothing changes there, and the wheels turn very slowly. But here, the things have happened very fast. If you take 2011, 2012,
yeah.
And you look at where we're at now. This is a maturing democracy.
This is a maturing democracy.
That the EFF and the DA can threaten the ANC in one of its strongest provinces just a few years after it had something like 70% of the total number of votes in that province.
Exactly.
That's incredible. And someone like Supra Mahumapelo, which you know, I don't think any political analyst would have said he was anything but comfortable in his position. More than a year and a half ago. Look at how he's now fighting for his life.
You know, Supra was so comfortable that he made up... You know, it would be so nice to go back to when we spoke about... you remember we spoke about Brian Molefe at Eskom?
Mm.
And how Brian Molefe suddenly pops up as a nominee by the Northwest ANC, and I think it was Hartebeespoort.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly a branch saying, Brian Molefe is a member of our branch, and we want him to go to parliament. And he did, by the way, go and serve as a member of parliament.
That was how he got his seat.
He got in because the minute the Guptas and Jacob Zuma said, I want Brian Molefe in parliament so that I can make him finance minister.
Supra gerrymandered it.
Exactly. He made it up. They made it up and they forged documents, and there was Brian Molefe in parliament as an MP. So the thing is this, people are not stupid. If you go back to when Lucas Mangope died earlier this year, so many people in the Northwest suddenly showed you that actually they have been looking at what is going on with the ANC leadership and governance and saying things were better. And this is a terrible thing, but they were saying things were better under Lucas Mangope during apartheid, during the Bantustan days. Things were better under these guys than sure. They are under an ANC government.
And that's some indictment. These are rural communities. These are not people in the cities.
No.
We tend to think.
No.
You know, we have our preconceived ideas about rural South Africa. But this shows you, even in the Northwest, where people are by no means easy to pull the wool over.
Exactly.
You know, you can't fool these people like you think you might. And politicians have such hubris.
Absolutely. So you, for me, that was a wake up call, and I don't know if the ANC actually listened enough. But if the ANC doesn't fire Supra Mahumapelo, doesn't put in a new cadre of leadership that says that we're going to turn things around, then the ANC will lose, or will go to 50% or maybe less in the Northwest. It's It's clear as daylight.
My only question, and then I'll leave the Northwest alone because we've given them way too much attention for 2 weeks in a row. But the Northwest service delivery is what eventually started to make the difference for people. They eventually were so sick and tired of this, of the, first of all, the corruption, and then the clinic situation that we know happened there with the Guptas being paid for setting up non-existent clinics. But service delivery was in the end the problem. There was no fresh water, there was no electricity, there were roads that were a problem. People in that province have been putting up with shit for how long now?
You know,
why does it take emergency measures before someone says, you know what, we're actually going to block the streets of Mahikeng, we're going to make this impossible for Supra?
Yeah, I mean, there's two. So first of all, you know, one of the things about the Northwest is that, you remember, we had a long, about a year and a half ago, we had a long chat about municipalities that were collapsing in the Northwest. They didn't have water. If you look at Des van Rooyen's list that came out last year, Des van Rooyen had a list of municipalities and Nomvula Mokonyane that were not paying for water.
Right.
Because they took the money and bought the mayor a BMW 7 whatever. You know, there are municipalities that are so deep in debt that they can't pay water, electricity, and so forth. So the Northwest, in fact, has been on this slow but very visible decline that we haven't really paid attention to. But all the pointers are that it's collapsed. And you know, last Wednesday, Cabinet announces that we're taking over the health department. That means that Cyril Supra Mahumapelo can't run his health department and government. Now people are running around, people from Treasury saying, let's fix the clinics you've spoken about, the hospitals, because they failed. He has absolutely failed. If I had failed to run my household like that, then I would be fired. That's why I say Supra is gone, because quite frankly, how does he stay on when someone else is running what he should be running, and that's his health department? Very soon it will be education. Very soon it will be some other department. His powers will be gone.
We've barely got time for one more, but I do think it's worth reflecting on, because we made such a fuss about social welfare and development. And this was Batabile Dlamini's department, and now it's Susan Shabangu's.
Yes.
And the guy who was put in charge, Batabile's choice, has now had to hightail it to KZN.
Yes.
What's happening in social welfare?
The new minister of social development, Susan Shabangu, went to parliament. First of all, you'll remember that that SASSA, the South African Social Security Agency, these are the guys who pay out the social grants, have gone through so much trauma and all sorts of things. And the CEO left. Batabile Dlamini went to KwaZulu-Natal and got someone who turned out to be, had links to her, to become the acting CEO, and that was the acting CEO. And now a new broom has come in, Susan Shabangu announced that the lady in question had asked to be sent back home to KwaZulu-Natal, to her regional office, where she will now go back to being the SASSA regional manager there. But a new guy has come in and he's acting as the CEO. But I think those moves are part of what we don't talk about enough. If you take, where was Jacob Zuma's power? It was in the intelligence services. Arthur Fraser has been moved to prisons from the National Intelligence Agency, from the South African Secret Service, and so forth. So there are key cogs in the Jacob Zuma administration, the civil servants, who are beginning to be moved out slowly but surely. And I think you'll see in mineral resources, other places, you'll see them moving as well, slowly, but I think surely. But the thing that interested me about Susan Chabangu appearing in Parliament over the yesterday was the fact that she said that there is no organizational structure at social development. That means that if you go there and say, who's in charge here? Mabali will say, I'm in charge. And Ben will say, I'm in charge. Justice will say, I'm in charge.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows who's in charge. Wow. So there isn't, you know, HR people will love this. There's an organogram and it puts Justice is the head honcho there. And then Mabali is the number two. Our Ben, sir, you're number seven. Sia, your number, you're in Mabale's office. Oh, Gareth, you're this and so forth. And it's nice. At social development, there was nothing. There's just, you know, it's like, I'm going to hire someone. Okay, hire them. What will they do? Oh, I don't know. Just hire them. And then they come in. But who will they report to? What's their function? No, just bring them on. Just hire them. So we spend 198 million rand a year on salaries. Yeah? Mm. 198 million rand a year. That's half the budget for social development as a department. Mm. Half 198 million on salaries for social development.
And then we still hire cash paymaster services because the department can't.
The department can't work. So this is what people say, oh, why are you hard on Batabile Dlamini and so forth? The thing is this. Imagine that you're spending 198 million rand a year on people who don't know who the boss is, who they report to, and they're just running around. Just, you know, it's just
like, chaos.
You know, I need this. Whose job is it? It's just chaos.
It's like a TV show. whose job is it anyway?
Whose job is it? So Susan Chabangu says, no, there was a structure in 2015, and then we looked at it, and the one in 2016 looked totally different to the one in 2015. So you wonder, so suddenly people who were bosses in 2015 are no longer bosses and this and that. In 2017, totally different structure.
And so it seems she just came in and did whatever she wanted.
Yes.
And was totally
That's the
coordinated
upshot.
And
that's the upshot. Now she's gone to the department that focuses on women empowerment. I think the struggle for gender equality, women and sub-emancipation is going to leap forward under Batabile Dlamini.
Nobody's excited. As a woman in South Africa, she can't wait. This is the moment they've been waiting for.
I feel thoroughly represented, and my my interests are being protected by the right people.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself.
All right, Justice. I did want to have your thoughts on Kanye West saying slavery was a choice. We were looking at this, trying to find some way to, you know, you want to be as objective and you want to be as fair as possible.
Yes.
I said that no matter how I look at this, no matter how I try and carve this chicken up, Kanye is historically ignorant.
Yeah.
Is there something I'm missing?
No, you know, I think I couldn't have put it better myself. But there was an amazing, interesting interview on CNN, I think, yesterday. And he gave an interview to, we're missing Sia here. But there's a
Ulf Blitzer?
No, not Ulf Blitzer.
Anderson Cooper?
So he gave an interview to someone from, I think it was Rolling Stone, magazine, and right. it's called Something the God.
Oh.
Hang on. I think you're talking about. Carry on. It will come
yes.
to me. Yes. Charlemagne the God.
Charlemagne the God
from the Breakfast Club.
Okay. Charlemagne the God. Do you think I could change my name?
No.
Justice the god.
The
archangel.
I like that, guys.
Too late for you, Justice.
Shalomi the god.
Justice is a fairly good name, if you ask me. I mean,
Oh my word.
So what did he say in this interview?
So Charlemagne the God says,
it's ridiculous.
I interviewed the guy 6 months ago, and you know, gave me a long interview and so forth. He says, you know, and they spoke a lot about mental health and so forth. So Charlemagne the God says, you know, he's being interviewed by Hala Gurani, and he says, you know, I think maybe not everything is okay up there, and maybe his family need to, you know, engage and see.
But what family? Have you seen this family that they're asking to engage? Do you remember? I mean, listen, first of all, we know Kanye had mommy issues. When his mother died, there was a big issue in his life, and he was very distraught, as anyone
but
would
maybe
be
his wife could have a word.
His wife? Have you seen the family she comes from?
Still, so Charlemagne the God says, I think that's where we need an intervention here. The family needs to come to the fore and you know, help us out here. Because
have you seen what Donald Trump said today?
Yeah,
Trump says, I want to thank Kanye West for being a friend, and then he says, my support among African-American males has doubled, which it has, according to this latest poll. I mean, who knows where these polls are?
No, it has. It was Kanye West alone, and now there's two guys. So, you know.
Okay,
certainly not Charlemagne the God.
All right, well, thank you, Justice.
Absolute pleasure.
There's the Burning Platform with Justice Malala, brought to you by Nando's. CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning.
This is CliffCentral.com.